You are listening to a podcast of the London Irish Business Society's event In Conversation with Siobhan Talbot of Glanbia and Stephen Vernon of Green REIT. This event was produced in association with Davy and took place in central London on the 2nd of December 2014. The discussion was moderated by Barry Dixon, Davy's head of research, who opens the conversation.
Thanks, Mark. I'm Barry Dixon. I'm head of research at Davy, and on behalf of LIBS and ourselves, we'd like to welcome you all here this evening for this, what I hope will be an interesting discussion around leadership. Davy's, as many of you know, is Ireland's largest stockbroking firm. We're also a wealth management business. And over the last few years, we've been developing our business and growing our business internationally, largely in response to the growth and the international growth of companies like Glanbia and businesses like Green REIT, who have really sort of led the trail in terms of international development. And we in Davy are proud to follow companies like that internationally. We have an office around the corner here for some of you who know that. But clearly our main business is based in Dublin, and for those of you who are interested in coming back or are back visiting, you know, please feel free to call into us on Dawson Street. We'd be delighted to see you and to talk to you. This evening, it's a great pleasure for me personally to introduce our two speakers. They're both very interesting people and leaders of businesses in their own right. Siobhan Talbot is Group Managing Director of Glanbia, and has been in that position for the past year. Prior to that, Siobhan was Group Finance Director and had responsibility for strategic development within Glanbia. And for those of you who mightn't be familiar with the story, it's an extraordinary story, an evolutionary story of an Irish dairy cooperative who has become a leader in global health nutrition, human health nutrition. And Siobhan, hopefully, will talk to us about that. Prior to her joining Glanbia in 1992, Siobhan was an accountant by profession, but I think we'll forgive her for that this evening. Our other speaker is Stephen Vernon, who many of you will know as being one of Ireland's leading property experts. Stephen is a director of Green REIT, which is the first real estate investment trust, which was listed on the Irish Stock Exchange last year, and has been instrumental, I suppose, in developing and transforming the Irish property scene through a new and innovative capital market solution to what was a problem market. He's an interesting character in his own right in that he's had a number of careers within the property industry, and I'd like to hopefully get some of his wisdom and his experience over time. So I thought we might start in terms of really looking at people, sort of, I suppose, the root of their ambition and drive, and maybe go on then and start to talk about or explore their leadership skills. And Siobhan, if I could start with you, if you don't mind, and, you know, I suppose reading about you, you know, you were a farmer's daughter from Kilkenny, from South Kilkenny, and I often wonder where the drive and ambition. Did you, as a little girl, sort of grow up wanting to be the boss of Glanbia? I mean, you know, in South Kilkenny, I'm sure you were steeped in the culture of the business. Or did you have, or did that ambition grow later in life?
I think it's fair to say it came later. I am indeed a farmer's daughter and delighted with that. But my father sadly passed away when I was only 15, and there's possibly nobody that would be more surprised at where I am now than indeed my late father. But having said that, dairy and agriculture is very much, I think if you grow up in rural Ireland, it's never too far from you. So I'm very pleased that that is my roots, but the ambition did definitely come later.
And did that sort of grow and evolve as you realised your own abilities and strengths? Or maybe you might just sort of talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
At what point did you realise, you know what, I'm actually going to do this. I'm going to leave this business.
I always think when somebody asks me that it would sound wonderfully fantastic to say I had this marvellous master plan when I was 10 years of age sitting in South Kilkenny. But the truth is I didn't. I always was interested in finance, as you said. My colleagues probably still haven't forgiven me for being an accountant now, in truth. But finance was at the core. I went to UCD, did a postgraduate there, trained at PwC. And I was very interested in finance. So probably the first step, in truth, was finance director of the group. That was possibly my first ambition, and I did have ambition for that. And I have to say that over my years, you know, I'm over 22 years now with Glanbia, And I really have to thank the guys and folk that I worked with along the way, because they were hugely supportive. And having made finance director then, when John was saying, you know, he was thinking of retiring, and he was very supportive, as indeed the chairman and the board were. So really it kind of came together quite quickly then once we got on that trajectory.
And I know that you have little time for glass ceilings or gender quotas, but I mean, and I suppose I have to ask the question, I mean, did you encounter any sort of resistance or challenges, I suppose, in terms of your route to the top of a company and probably, you know, thinking about the co-op part of it, very male-dominated business?
Well, you know, there's no doubt when I started with the organisation, it was incredibly different to what it is today. And interestingly, I started to head up an internal audit function in Waterford Foods at the time. So not only was an accountant, I was female. Internal audit was probably not something that they were massively enthused about. So there was all sorts of interesting challenges. The gender thing, I think in all honesty, I'd have to say no. When I think of the finance director of Waterford that recruited me when I came to work with Jeff in Avonmore post the merger, really, no. I think at the end of the day, it was a piece of you worked hard, showed the fact that you were ambitious to think beyond the job you had that minute in time. I really couldn't say that I had particular challenges. In fairness, I think the challenges are no more than any parent faces. Probably the biggest challenge is that ultimate juggling. I have two teenagers. When they were small, I was travelling a lot. So I think it's quite frankly, it's not. I see it not as a gender challenge. I see it just as that normal parental type challenge where you're juggling all these things and working hard at the same time.
Sure, sure. And I know that you had a health scare in 2010, and that I suppose it's interesting. You've spoken about that publicly in the past, and in terms of just trying to understand how did that impact on your ambition, or drive or motivation.
Yeah, no, I did. I had I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2010. And it was, it's not something you expect, so it's a complete bolt out of the blue. And that's challenging. There's nothing particularly good about that diagnosis except getting through it. And I suppose the way I looked at it, a few comments I'd make. Firstly, I looked at it pretty much as a project at the time. I was fortunate that as part of a health check that Glanbia offers to our employees, it was found. I wouldn't have found it myself. So in an odd way, from the outset, I felt lucky and unlucky all at the same time. But that meant that I could look at it as in a particular perspective. I think what that did do is that it did give me a different perspective. You know, it's quite trite to say what doesn't kill you makes it stronger, but it does, really. So I think, for example, when this opportunity came up then, I sort of said to myself, and obviously consulted with my husband, as you would, and your family, that, you know what, I'm interested in this. I've always loved the Glanbia organisation. I love what I do. And when the opportunity came, that probably gave me the perspective to say, do you know what, I'm going to go for this.
Excellent. And Stephen, if I could move to you, and you know, looking at your own sort of background, father from Dundalk, your mother's people from South Kilkenny, and I believe we actually figured
that
they were
in common.
Almost related. what brought you back to Ireland, I suppose, in many ways? Was it your identification of the property opportunity, or was it a return to your roots, or how would you describe it?
I mean, I wouldn't describe myself as having Irish roots. I was born and brought up in Bristol, and I'm a Christian Brothers survivor. So that led to university in London and then a career in the city, which lasted for about 20 years. And I ended up as the managing partner of one of the old city chartered surveying firms with offices around Europe and in the States and in Japan. And the problem was I became managing partner when I was 37. And by the time I'd done two terms, I was terrified about what on earth was going to happen going forward. There was no way I was going to go back into the sort of bosom of the partnership and be a chartered surveyor again. I had little interest in advising clients anymore. And so I was really quite concerned about how my career... I was far too young to think about, you know, packing it in. I felt completely unfulfilled. So I decided about 3 years before I resigned that I would resign after my second term as managing partner and began thinking, laying down some plans. So I had a small property company with two Greek shipping people who were absolutely wonderful people and had lots of money, and we had a small property company which they funded, and we ran it as a sort of hobby, really, and we built some offices in Antwerp, and we did some stuff in London and various things like that. And then the other thing I did was I went on the board of Green as a non-executive director because I could see that the founder of the company, who did wonderful things in terms of building up the company at the physical real estate level, buying the land for Blanchardstown and so on. But the company was going nowhere as a PLC. And I knew that there would be an opportunity at some point there. So when I left, it was simply an opportunity. The fact that it was in Ireland was completely random. I had been to see some headhunters when Ron Spinney got the job of running Hammerson's and said, would I have got that job? And was told, no way. Coming from private practice, you wouldn't get a job running a serious real estate company. And in Ireland, there is a blur. People don't get the difference between the industry and the profession. So I spoofed my way in because they thought I was an investor and a developer when I wasn't. I was a chartered surveyor, which is a completely different gig. But it worked out. And then luckily, I arrived in 93 with the Celtic Tiger sitting next to me on the Aer Lingus EI-151. So it all got off to a good start.
OK. And if I can move on, maybe I'll come back to you, Siobhan, in terms of Glanbia and the evolution of Glanbia, as I said earlier, from a sort of a small Irish dairy processing company to a global nutrition business, which it is today. And maybe just talk us through that evolution, I mean, which yourself and John, you know, were really the architects of. And maybe talk to us about whether it was part of a grand plan or whether it evolved over time with, you know, a cheese business in the US, literally sort of a byproduct of which was whey, and then you move from whey into protein isolates and into the nutrition business. Just in terms of the thinking on that, was it accidental or was it all part of this grand strategy?
Sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. So I probably to start the story, I'd go back to the merger that created Glanbia, which was a merger of Avonmore and Waterford, two big Irish food companies. A lot of excitement at the time around that entity that was created. And it's fair to say that we had some fairly challenging years fairly immediately after that merger. We had very diverse businesses. We had a lot of businesses here in the UK. We had meat businesses, we had food service, cheese, liquid milk. So a lot of diverse, but not particularly strong market positions immediately post the merger. So we had a few tough years, and then we came into the early 2000s. And we did a strategy work at that point and identified nutrition as an area that we were fundamentally interested in with our core dairy capability. But quite frankly, that was a bit academic because we didn't have the money. And we couldn't really tap equity markets by virtue of our structure. So at that point in time, we had probably no more than ambition. And we characterised the next phase of the Glanbia development where we had to earn the right to grow. So we went through a series of portfolio readjustment, if you want to call that, like that. Effectively, we closed businesses, we disposed of businesses, really exited a lot of our businesses here in the UK, exited the meat businesses that we had in both Ireland and the UK, and pretty much set our sights to the US and the nutrition agenda. And that worked really well for us. And so we then started, I would think, very robustly on the twin-track approach of organic development and acquisition. So from the early stages, we started to build in the early 90s a very large-scale cheese business in the US, growing with our farmer patrons in a very good business model, while acquiring nutrition business along the side. So our first business, we really started the acquisition agenda in 2004, 2006. We bought two non-dairy blending, very nice nutritional businesses. And at the same time, we were doing huge expansions in the US. And maybe to put that in colour for you, when we started in the US in early 1990, we did about 7,000 tonnes of cheese. Last year, we did 400,000 tonnes of cheese. So that's been the scale of our large scale, our ambition in the US to now being the largest player in American-style cheddar cheese. So from that, as you rightly say, we developed this capability in whey processing. And whey, again, to many of you that might not know the basics of dairy, whey was this problem child of cheese making. It was land spread, fed to pigs. Basically, you had to get rid of it. And then people like ourselves recognised that there was very strong nutritional profile to whey protein, particularly in sports nutrition, because it has very high-quality branched-chain amino acids, good for muscle building and recovery. So we started to invest in capital, essentially to concentrate the product into these high-protein powders and started to sell it into sports nutrition. And probably the big step change for us then came in 2008 when we bought one of our customers. We bought Optima Nutrition at the time. I remember a lot of folk looking at us in 2008 and John and myself out saying, you know, we've just bought this, we think it's a great idea. And people saying, what in the honour of God's name have you done? Did you not realise there's a recession in the US and the US consumer mightn't be in a great place? But we had the courage of our convictions. We saw this as not... People saw it as more counterintuitive than we did, in fact. We saw it as very logical. We saw it as going up the value chain of
our cultural shift, nonetheless, though. I mean, a different culture of business.
Well, we were comfortable with consumer because we'd had a large-scale consumer business in Ireland for many years. So it wasn't like that whole concept of B2C gave us huge moments of fear. Maybe at one level we didn't know it, we didn't know either. So that can give you confidence. So we bought Optimum Nutrition. That is what that essentially then became our platform in our performance nutrition business. We bought another brand in 2011. We bought two more brands this year. And maybe to scale that for you, if you take the businesses we bought since 2008, together they'd be about $400 million. We're now $1 billion. So in a very short period of time, we've become a big player. And we believe, modestly, that we have the best brands in the space. We believe that we bring great capability to it from an ingredient set as well as a consumer set. So now we're very clear that we have two global growth platforms. We have a very fine global ingredients business with a large-scale cheese and whey and non-dairy angles to it. We have a large performance nutrition business, and then we have a number of strategic joint ventures that are very much a strategic enabler to that global growth platforms.
And as the leader of that business, I mean, culturally, are they very diverse? I mean, in terms of those two platforms, in terms of the ingredients business and the performance nutrition business, I mean, are they culturally very different, and how do you, as the leader of those, manage those twin cultures?
For sure. They are a bit... I mean, the fact that we have four segments, all of the business, and we have a number of business units, they all have their own cultures, as you rightly say. There's undeniably a bit of razzmatazz that goes with performance nutrition, as it should. You won't necessarily find that same razzmatazz, but we have a very fine agribusiness, but a little bit different. And my job, obviously, is, as you rightly say, to have a cohesive umbrella over that. And one of the things that we did last year, actually, under the banner of an Our Glanbia programme, I visited all the sites, had an opportunity to engage directly with 3,000 of our 5,000 employees. And one of the things that I found really, really positive, having been in the organisation even myself a long time, was the level of engagement, enthusiasm, absolute pride and delight at learning about the rest of the group. So whether I was in Florida in BSN and they were learning about the agribusiness in Ireland or agribusiness learning about Florida, huge enthusiasm. So while I have no doubt there's more we will be doing on that, my belief is that you can have independent cultures where they sit appropriately within the business units and have a very nice, solid, overarching Glanbia culture as to what it stands for to be part of the overarching piece.
Okay. And Stephen, if I could maybe turn to you now in terms of your own history and for, as you say, called yourself a spoofer going in, you certainly did very well in terms of green property from 1993. I think you had sort of 24 million or so under management to when you took the business private in 2002 when it was worth $1.5 billion. I suppose I find it extraordinary when reading your history in many ways that you had the courage to take the business private, and maybe just the thought process behind that. Here you are, the CEO of a relatively large, successful property business in Ireland. Why did you take it private? Was it because it was such a discount to NAV? Did you see the opportunity for personal wealth gain, or maybe just
I'm still reeling at the thought of 400,000 tonnes of cheese. It's like a pile that's bigger than my office box. But to answer your question...
Easier to carry around.
I mean, basically what happened was that the market cap of Green had fallen from the time it had its IPO in 1985, because the IPO was an end game for the investors in what was a private business from the time it was founded. Green will be 50 years old next year, and it was a club deal with some English institutions like ESN Pension Fund, ICI Pension Fund, the founder, AIB funds, and so on. And the listing was ostensibly to finance the construction of Blanchardstown. But there was a large element of an end game for the investors. And then what happened was, because of all the fighting over Liffey Valley and so forth, it wasn't possible to build Blanchardstown. And so when that didn't happen, the company became more and more unpopular. The gearing rose to significantly over 100%, and the shareholders really wanted out and were being promised the world and all by other developers who were saying to the shareholders, look, get rid of the people in Green and we will build Blanchardstown. So when I joined, I mean, in March 93, the market cap had fallen to about 9 million. And then that's when the founder resigned. I agreed to join. And by the time I joined in September, it already crept up to 24. But then we got lucky and bought Dublin City Properties within a month or two, did a rights issue, signed up Dunn Stores. And by the following summer in 94, we were on site building the town of Blanchardstown. Now, the company for the next 9 years was a listed company and outperformed every other listed real estate vehicle in Europe by a margin. But the business plan didn't suit the shareholders because it was based on what I wanted to do. So we were in prime real estate in Dublin. We were in secondary industrial in the UK. We were the fourth largest landlord of industrial property in Britain, which was a cash cow designed to hedge the idea that Blanchardstown wouldn't let. But then it did let. And then we had a great business anyway, buying secondary industrial. Then we did prime office developments around the M25 around London. And then we had an opportunistic theme where we bought other companies and portfolios. So we bought, in a hostile takeover bid, we took over Trafford Park Estates in 98. We bought P&O's non-operational real estate with Goldman Sachs. And by having that combined business plan, we outperformed. But the shareholders didn't like it one bit. I mean, they wanted me to just have Irish property, and then you can be the proxy for Irish property. And I would say, well, what happens when Irish property crashes? And they would say, well, we'd have sold you by then. Great. So we got to 2002, when listed real estate companies, we hadn't got REITs in Europe yet. They were in America. There was the obvious tax leakage and so forth. And there were serious question marks over the whole survival of the sector. People seriously thought that land securities might not survive. And there were more and more take privates. We had a market cap of 600 million. We had shareholders' funds of almost exactly a billion. And we had assets of 1.85, almost 2 billion. So we were 100% geared to shareholders' funds, but trading on a 40% discount to NAV, which was one of the highest in the sector. And what drove me to take it private was total and utter frustration at the idea that the shareholders were only going to make money if I could deliver NAV. And some of the most loyal ones were saying, you know, look, we've supported your rights issues, we've backed you for 5, 6, 7 years, but, you know, you're going to have to find a way to deliver. And then at the same time, there were a lot of very kind of crazy predators hanging around in Ireland, mainly builders and developers and speculators, who would at that stage, by 2002, have been quite capable of taking the company out, leaving me with the value of a few options, having basically built the entire company. So what happened then was that there wasn't unanimity of agenda in the management group. So I couldn't rely on my colleagues. And probably for the only time in my career, I had to go on my own. I mean, the other thing we have in common, other than South Kilkenny, is the fact it's always been a team. And it was a great team that built Green in those days. It wasn't just me. But I went on my own, and I got two banks, and just made a bid for the company and got thrown out. And then Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Lehman's all came in trying to beat my bid. Some of them trying to get rid of me, some of them not trying to get rid of me, just trying to get rid of the banks that were backing me and then bring me back in, kind of thing. But we won it with Merrill Lynch and Bank of Scotland. And then we realised that selling down the assets was a much better bet than trying to buy things. So from 02 to when it was really all over in 05, 06, within 18 months or 2 years of paying 2 billion for the debt and assets, we had sold 1.5 and still had 1.5. Mm. So you can imagine what that did to the IRR. The promote went completely off the clock, and we were able to buy out the banks. Mm. So that left Green then as almost like a private family trust, because by then we owned, myself and my colleagues owned the whole thing, which today is Blanchardstown and all of those assets. That's now been parked. And then 6 years ago, we started a completely new business, really. It flies under the Green banner, but it's really the creation of Pat Gunn and myself. And that works on venture situations, doing workouts for the banks. And more recently, we've listed the REIT, but that's the creation of the two of us. And it's not really the same business, but it has the same staff, and it flies under the same banner.
And what one of the things I find extraordinary is that you almost in some way, and I know you dispute this, would you semi-retired somewhat in 2005, 2006. And for a property guy, I mean, I think it was Keynes that said that, you know, for bubbles to exist, the great and the good must believe in them. But yet you seemed to avoid the entire bubble in the Irish property market. And I just wonder what was the sort of self-belief or self-discipline in you that sort of made you do that, made you sort of not get involved, because it must have been tempting when you.
Well, I mean, I expected to make some money from the take private, but a modest amount of money. And what happened was, obviously, because of what I've just explained, we made an enormous amount of money, and I thought, well, why would we throw...
You can't roll the dice again.
No.
Why not?
You go in the casino, you make some money, the last thing you do is roll the dice again. So we stood back in amazement at the pricing of things. We made a bid on a few things just for the hell of it, really. But, I mean, we would never say... I was always absolutely sure before we made the bids that we would be miles off the pace. We bid £140 million for the Bank of Ireland headquarters in Baggot Street, knowing it would go for significantly over £200 million, which it did. So we were careful not to buy anything. It was too dangerous to go to the office, you see. That's the problem. When you get a property downturn, you really need to get out of the office, and because you just might be tempted to do a deal. So you need to go to somewhere like the Arctic or South America or something like that.
Which you did do.
Which I did, yeah. Yeah. I hung out in the Galapagos and stuff in case I was tempted to do a deal.
Possibly God. Lots of folk wish they did likewise.
Yeah. And so you came back in yourself and Pat Gunn through Green Ventures, which was initially, correct me if I'm wrong, was a sort of a workout type solution.
Well, we didn't know what the plan was. Basically, I moved back to Ireland. I moved to Ireland permanently sort of 7 years ago, thinking I'm going to have to do something to stop this whole thing becoming a kind of boring family trust. Because that's what happens with real estate companies. As the people that found them get older and they make some money, they tend to become intensely risk-averse. Because why would you bet the ranch when you've got enough money? And I thought, I don't want that. I want Green. Because there's this big team of people in Green, people like Jim McKenna, without whom I could never have survived in Ireland. And I wanted the company to have a future. So I went back to do some kind of deal, list it again or raise money on a club deal with institutions. And what happened was not that. It was the arrival of Pat, who had sold his own family business to CBRE and was looking for something to do. And so we decided to get together and become equal partners in a new business. But we didn't know what that business was. And it didn't have any capital in it. We didn't need to put capital in it. So we went to all the banks when the crash came and said, look, trust is the new capital. There's no point us putting money into these deals. The money's already gone in. What you need is somebody that can actually deal with everything for you and get you your money back. So the two really big deals that we did were AIB in the UK, when they found they'd lent the guts of £1 billion to a guy that was being chased by the police and who's now in prison. So we took over his stuff. And in Lloyds in Ireland, their larger loans, which was a book of around £4.5 billion, again, they needed somebody to get a grip on that. And that is our speciality. We very rarely buy individual buildings. It's always portfolios or companies. So this played to our strengths, really, the idea that we could take on, with no due diligence, big portfolios and really work them. And that was how we've spent the recession. And it enabled us to hire people, lots of ladies, lots of ladies in green, because they were the best people applying for the job, frankly. So I echo what you're saying. And then, come the beginning of 2013, we realised the workout business was nearly finished. We've just sold the last portfolio, which is Spectrum, which has been sold in Ireland. And it's almost finished. We're selling up in the UK now. You probably saw we sold 111 Buckingham Palace Road a couple of weeks ago, the Telegraph headquarters here. And the market had turned in September 2012. And then by 2013, it was clear that we were seeing the start of a proper recovery. So we decided to get back to our roots and raise capital. We spent 2 or 3 months debating how to do that. We looked at an AIM listing in London. We looked at club deals with institutions. And then the REIT thing came along. And I didn't think that would work for us at first. But the more we looked at it, the more we thought it probably does, actually. And what it does, it gives us capital quickly. And it's discretionary capital so that we can operate in the Irish market without having some investment committee in the US, which is what happens with private equity. We had tried to work with TPG, who were great guys, but it just didn't work. They were making the decisions. We would have ended up working for them, and we didn't want that. So the REIT ticked the boxes. It was discretionary money fast. And we got it by July last year. And then, of course, the minute we got the money, everybody went on holiday, and we never really got going until September. So we're only just over a year into this. And we've raised in two tranches. We had to do a double raise because it was a blind pool, externally managed. Everyone hates that. So we went for 300 just to kick it off and then got the other 400 in the spring. And we've invested about 750 million or a little bit over that now. And so we've got, you know, a nice fully invested company. We still have the headroom of the gearing to invest. We don't want any more money. We've invested it really well, and we're going to play out the hand we have, including doing developments, obviously.
And Siobhan, you're almost a year into your role as the head of Glanbia, and I suppose just interesting to get your perspective in terms of how you see the business evolving under your stewardship. You're a relatively young CEO. You know, you're managing a business of $2.5 billion of revenues, almost $4 billion of market cap, with an international. What's the vision, or what's your sort of plan, if you like, for your stewardship of the business?
Yeah, our strategy, I think, has been quite clear, particularly over the last 2 years or so, which is really about driving forward those two global growth platforms, having and getting the best out of our strategic joint ventures, and then our Dairy Ireland business will sustain pretty much as it is. So we came out actually last March and in a moment of bravery said we were going to seek to grow 8 to 10% this year, and what hopefully won't be a moment of foolishness said we were going to seek to do that for the next 5 years. So we are very ambitious as a management team that we believe we have great platforms in that core health and nutrition space as an ingredient player and as a specialist nutrition provider. So I see us as playing into that general health trend and the recognition of protein as a good nutritious food, both as a mainstream provider, as an ingredient, as I say, and then as performance nutrition. We have a really good model in performance nutrition where we roll out our brands, which are very good in the US, across lots of different geographies. They travel well, they're seeing as very good brands in the space. We've invested a lot behind infrastructure and capability. And to the piece you said earlier about culture and team, yeah, and you rightly said, Steve, I mean, ultimately it all comes down to the people. And that 5,000 people that we have in Glanbia are truly fantastic ambassadors and drivers of the organisation. And what's really great for me and the rest of the executive team, now we're attracting really fantastic talent into the organisation. You know, we had a capital markets event. Paul and Jack were there last week. They were doing their push-ups and exercise training all in the morning. They're new men since it, actually.
But we haven't noticed.
We're bringing in talent now that's, you know, Procter & Gamble, Nike, Adidas, Apple. Those type of resources now are coming into the organisation. And I think we have a really nice blend of an organisation that doesn't take itself too seriously. We're very grounded. Our roots are very clear. We'll go out to information meetings now next week. We'll be down in Wexford and Kilkenny talking to our Irish farmers about their ambition to grow. And at the same time, we'll do all the institutional work with our institutional investors. So I think that culture keeps us very grounded. I think our strategic path will be to continue to grow out our capability on the ingredient side. We'd like to acquire businesses. What has stood us in good stead is that blend of organic growth and acquisition. We are disciplined acquirers, so we are very clear on the metrics and the hurdle rates that sit around our acquisition ambitions. And I think that organic growth, as we all know, is the cheapest form of development. So I think we'll continue to have a nice blend of both organic growth and acquisition.
And does the buck stop with you in terms of that ambition and that sort of plan, and even in terms of thinking out that plan for the next 10 years? I mean, is that yours? I mean, is that your responsibility, or again, does it come back to the team?
For sure. No, clearly, as Group Managing Director, absolutely, it is my responsibility to deliver the ambitious targets we set out, but the team are just behind me there. ultimately, it is about the team. We have a very strong executive team, we have a very strong management committee, and we have a very strong pipeline of talent in the organisation. We're bringing in new people all the time, and people like to come in now, I think, to Glanbia because we have ambition for our Irish operations, and we've a lot of ambition for our international operations, and we give great career choices. You know, a simple example, we get huge applications for our graduate programme, and we run a really good graduate programme where they get a chance to go right across the organisation. And in fact, testimony to it is the fact that sometimes business units will want to hold on to the young folk and not leave them go on to the next business for experience, and we say no, it's part of a programme. So we have all those standard talent development pieces, as you say, but ultimately, absolutely, we'll drive it forward.
If you look out 10 years and, you know, Siobhan Talbot's legacy in Glanbia, what do you think? You're looking at a $10 billion revenue company? Is that sort of in your mind's eye? Or
well, Without any hostage. No, there's too many analysts here in the room that be taking our numbers, and doing the compound math. But no, at the end of the day, we've been very clear that we are ambitious. We're equally clear and we're realistic and have been around long enough to say it's not always a linear trajectory. And the reality is what has made our organisation strong over the years is how we've coped with the tough times we've had as well. And we've had those, and we've had cycles, and Dairy World is a cycle. But I think that organisational strength will carry us through, and ultimately, absolutely, we will seek to have strong growth over the next number of years.
And Stephen, I'll ask the question, any plans to retire anytime soon?
No.
Do you still think that there's value in the Irish property market?
They're two different questions.
Given your history, though, I think they might be...
About retirement is, for me, that would be really kind of like the end. The good thing about real estate is
we're all watching you.
I don't have 5,000 people or 400,000 tons of cheese. It's a tiny business at that level. I mean, we have 40 people in Dublin and about 6 in London. And it's quite a simple business in that sense. My role is to debate constantly with Pat where things are going and what we should be doing. And then he, these days, as chief executive, is really at the forefront of executing that strategy. But the key debate is the one that we have constantly. Are yields compressing too fast? What's going to happen to interest rates relative to sentiment towards real estate? What are the clouds on the horizon? Where can we improve returns by selling rather than buying? Is the risk-reward ratio correct to allow us to develop a building or not? That's where it is. And that's great. The other thing is that real estate is a very small milieu. Although if you go to a dinner party in Ireland and you sit next to somebody, they'll tell you they're in real estate without fail. Even if they're, in fact, a consultant surgeon or something, they'll tell you they're in real estate. And the reality is right across Europe, there's actually an incredibly small number of people that are really in it. And that's a milieu that you get to know over the years. And I've been at this now since I graduated in 1972. With essentially the same people through private equity, through public companies, through the stockbroking investment banks and so on. And, I enjoy that milieu and it's much more fun than being retired. But I'm going to do a sort of Rolling Stones job and fade out very slowly over the next 20 years. The other thing is that I still have a job to do because by far the biggest thing in my professional career has been the construction of Blanchardstown, which was just a site when I arrived in Ireland in 93. And is now a really vibrant town. There are 6,000 people employed there. We've built ancillary things. It's not just a shopping mall, it's a town. There's a theatre, there's a hotel, there's some residential. And actually, we have planning consent for at least another 1 million square feet. It's that we're only about 60% of the way through the development. And I want to stay with it and, over the next 10 years, try and finish that off.
And maybe a slightly different way of asking the same question is in terms of, do you still see that there's value in the Irish property market? And I suppose a related question in the sense that, we're now in an environment where economic growth is accelerating in Ireland. We have a Eurozone-imposed, very low interest rate environment. The ingredients are there bubble. And I suppose the question is, do you think that that can happen or have we learned sufficient lessons in terms of properly regulating the industry or regulating the banks in order to prevent that from happening again?
Well, how long do you want? I mean, I think there is an element of the Groundhog Day. I mean, throughout the noughties, the Financial Times was saying, poor Ireland. It has the wrong interest rates. It's going to have a bubble. It's going to burst. We were saying in Ireland, this is ridiculous. Life is great, isn't it? And then it happened. And now we have interest rates set for France with zero growth. We have growth more akin to the UK and the US. And all of that is inclined to create an asset bubble. And the obvious asset, of course, is real estate, which is why we have now corrected at a breathtaking speed. We've seen at least 200 basis points of yield compression pretty much across the board, and more than that in some sectors. Rental growth, the story around rental growth in offices in Dublin is a very good one because there is really no vacant space available. I mean, the vacancy rate for grade A space in Dublin 2 and 4 is probably lower than the West End here. And with very little in the pipeline actually being built, it's obvious that the rental growth is going to take us back to previous peaks, which were sort of 55, 60 euros, and they're not there yet. So there's a good story there. When you move outside of that, it's not really clear what's going to happen. I mean, retail is only at the very beginnings of a recovery. There's not much sign of anything happening on industrial. So I'm very optimistic. And, I mean, it's not my job to call the market. And if I had some insight into what was going to happen, I certainly wouldn't be sharing it with people here today. I mean, that's the last thing I would do. But, I mean, I will state the obvious, which is that, you know, we are going to, I think, have a few good years. And then you say, well, what then? I don't believe in soft landings in most of these markets. You never get soft landings in real estate markets. And the clouds on the horizon, potentially a few years out, will be rising interest rates with, in parallel with that, falling demand for real estate globally, and possibly a development boom that will be going on in Ireland over the next few years. There's going to be lots of jobs created in construction. There's going to be a huge development boom, all of which is pretty good. Mm.
And on that optimistic note, I think we might draw the formal interview to a close, and we can open it up to Q&A from people. I think we have probably 15 or 20 minutes for Q&A if there are any questions from the audience. Any brave souls? Yes, we have one.
Question for Siobhan. Do you see Glanbia looking to the east towards China now?
Yeah, it's interesting. We do probably almost $400 million of business in China, largely as an ingredient supplier that we've done for a number of years. We were out there recently, it has to be said. Those of you that get home a lot know Avonmore, hopefully, one of the best brands in the country, second only to Coca-Cola, etc., etc. And we did recently launch Avonmore, actually, in China. So we did, for the first time ever, recently invest in having long-life capability. And one of the learnings with one of the folk, actually, when we were out in Shanghai recently launching it, they were quite taken by the fact when I told them it was actually more efficient for us to ship long-life milk to Asia than it was to truck fresh milk around the island of Ireland. So that was an interesting learning. But yes, it is of interest. Our primary capability, it's fair to say, is in the US and Europe, but we are clearly interested in it as a demand market, the fundamental underpin of dairy markets, which have been firm through 13 and into 14, has been demand from Asia, particularly serviced from New Zealand. So I think there'll be all sorts of opportunities. As an ingredient supplier, for sure, I'd like the branded position in Ireland would be great if that takes off. And then for the island of Ireland, from a milk processing capability, because one of the things we didn't speak to is the fact that we're very excited about the fact that we're building the first dairy facility in Ireland in a generation in South Kilkenny. Because quotas are going.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, exactly. In 2015. And regions like Asia will be exciting for that business because obviously we produce far more dairy in Ireland than we consume. And so then all export markets will be interesting.
Question here.
It's a question for Stephen. What's been your interaction with NAMA over the years and what's your impression of the job they've done?
Glad you asked that.
I was just waiting for it. You know? It's kind of like the elephant in the room. My interaction with it is that we bought from them. We bought two assets, Central Park, and we just bought a building in Dawson Street opposite the Davy HQ, which we're going to redevelop. And that's really my only dealings with NAMA. So I'm not really going to comment on that. I mean, we simply bought from them. If you want my observation on NAMA, I would be anxious not to be seen to be critical of NAMA. So you've got to put what I say into context. I think they've done, you know, a remarkable job in very, very difficult circumstances. They were set up with a particular mandate, and obviously it was very difficult for them to, for example, sell development sites in Ireland that would get development going because they weren't worth anything. You know, the residual valuation of land is more volatile than the finished buildings. So the problem is that almost all sites, technically on paper, were worth almost zero or minus amounts. That's the problem. So they've timed that, taken the low-hanging fruit in the UK, executed quite well. The two observations that I would make, and this is not criticism, it's just an observation, is that I think it was never really... I followed the story. I've read everything that's been written about them and I've listened to public statements. And I cannot work out whether their mandate was to be a real estate company or a debt collection agency. And the two things are completely different. Now, one minute they're one thing and the next minute they're the other. So they often talk about the fact that their mandate is to get the money back, get the debts back. And a lot of their staff, I think, are what they call case officers, who are working with individual borrowers to get the money back. But then 5 minutes later, you know, people are saying, well, this is a really large real estate company. And I think that definition of the mandate is really an unresolved issue. I don't see where they're heading with that. And that would affect the staff and the people and the expertise, because you want different expertise for the two different roles. And then the other thing is that I think they're clearly heading for a scenario where they can end it, which was their original mandate. There is oodles of capital around for real estate, particularly Irish real estate, and they're able to do large portfolio sales either of loans or of direct assets. And I think going forward, what would be really good is if they facilitate developers to develop and they plan their own exit as was planned. And the thing that I personally would have an issue with is the idea that they're going to morph into some sort of developer. Now, I don't know if you've seen the Irish Times this morning, they've announced that they're going to develop Boland's Mill, which is a highly technical, sophisticated development, and they're going to do it. So, I don't know. That would be my only observation there. But I'm not being critical. I think they have, in difficult circumstances, they've done a really good job.
Question down the back.
Stephen, just following on from performance of Ritz, how much is Dublin the main driver?
Well, I think there's a trend right across Europe back towards the Middle Ages, in the sense that it's about city-states. You know, it's about London rather than the whole UK. It's about Milan. It's about cities that are doing well in their own regions rather than countries. And that is no different in Ireland. I mean, it is really very much about Dublin. Against that, in the Lloyd's portfolios that we've been selling, I think we've been slightly surprised at the buoyancy of the market outside of Dublin. But that's because the lot sizes tend to be much smaller and it's attracting local players. The debt markets are coming back fast in Ireland. I mean, up until 18 months ago, there was very little real estate debt available. Now that's quite different. And the margins on big ticket loans, which is the ones the banks want to make, have probably halved inside 18 months.
And do you really see that urbanisation trend sort of evolving in Ireland as it has, let's say, in other European countries?
Yeah, I mean, Dublin just gets bigger and bigger relative to everything else. Cork, Galway and Limerick are the three other cities, effectively. But you've got to put it into context. I mean, if you compare that with the UK provincial cities, that's very small. And the dynamism of Dublin is the thing. If you take the six largest provincial cities in the UK, which is Glasgow and Edinburgh, Birmingham and Manchester, I think Leeds and Bristol, and you take the combined office take-up of all those six, Dublin is 50% of that, of the combined. And I mean, two or three of those cities are bigger than Dublin. I mean, Dublin is a very dynamic market. If you take the recovery of the office markets across Europe, Dublin is recovering much faster than, say, Madrid, because in Madrid the demand is all domestic, whereas in Dublin probably 80% of the demand is non-domestic. You know, it's a much more kind of dynamic and globalised environment, which is why I'm optimistic about Dublin offices.
Question here.
Sorry, Stephen.
I'm getting the brunt of this.
The murmurings in the London real estate market are that there's going to be a slowdown in transactions pending the election next year. Do you think Dublin faces the same situation?
You mean whether the
whether will be a slowdown?
Well, I mean, obviously there are a lot of concerns about the way the political environment is going in Dublin, but I'm not going to comment on that publicly. I would really be putting my head in the noose. I don't see it slowing it down, though. I think that there is still a lot of capital trying to get into Ireland, and it's not exactly a self-fulfilling prophecy, but there's an element of that. And I think we will see quite a lot of transactions where some of the private equity guys that got in early will want to sell on, and you'll see stuff going around in a circle for a while.
And Siobhan, maybe just ask you, I mean, in terms of your own consumer business in Ireland, are you sort of seeing any sort of improvement or how would you characterise it?
You know, it has been a tough few years. I would say the retail environment is tough. I think the consumer has been very well educated, not to value, but actually to price, because I think our products obviously are great value. And I don't see that changing, in truth. And the discounters have taken a whole different role in that retail scene. It's fair to say, though, that we would see some stabilisation of late, but our core strategy in those businesses has been to recognise that, right-size the businesses for the longer term, and then really look to, for example, bringing the brand overseas as well. Because when you have fantastic brands, but, you know, 4 million of population, it's a small pond you're fishing in. So fundamentally, I think that general consumer confidence, you'd have to say overarching, is positive. It can take a bit of time to work through areas like the food space, but seeing stability in recent times, I think. Okay.
Hi, Siobhan. Yeah, just in terms of the global expansion of Glanbia and so forth, why are so many sort of former co-ops, dairy companies in Ireland going on their own? Is there an opportunity for Glanbia and, say, Kerry to merge now at this point and just step forward globally more significantly?
There's been a lot of debate and commentary over the years about consolidation of the Irish dairy sector. The first few comments I'd make. Firstly, a lot of cooperation happens on the ground. You know, we've a small island, we've a very seasonal milk production profile, a bell-shaped curve, because obviously we produce it efficiently off grass. So on the ground, at operating level, there'll be a lot of cooperation between the processors. Affecting a large-scale merger is very difficult for all the understandable historical reasons of politics, name over the door, you know, deep connections with their heritage and history. I actually think the model that we have now actually is a really good model. You know, in 2012, you might remember, we effectively did a joint venture with our largest shareholder, where our large-scale processing business now in Ireland is 40% owned by the PLC and 60% owned by the co-op. And that's actually a very good model, because what that really did is essentially give huge impetus. It didn't change the strategy of the PLC, but it meant we could give it renewed impetus while at the same time supporting the ambitions of our shareholders in Ireland and stakeholders to grow. And they're, you know, they have an ambition to expand their output by 60% by 2020. The reality is it is very much a global scale. Our competitors are global. We focus less rightly about competing on the island of Ireland from a large-scale dairy point of view than we do about turning our sights to the global world. So we will do sensible things all the time. What we say is Glanbia is there to do sensible things with processors in terms of having efficient processing. I think our farmers rightly would expect us to do that. So whether that's looking at assets we already have or not investing unnecessarily in assets to support that expansion, large-scale mergers are very difficult.
Question here.
Just for Siobhan as well. Here, IDA and Bordia trumpeting Ireland's future for feeding, I think it's 50 million plus people in a few years. What do you see as the major challenges to achieving that target and what we do to support it?
Yeah, I think what's really interesting in my time, and particularly in the recent years, that the government has very much woken up to the opportunity that is agriculture in Ireland. If you take, you know, back in the early 80s when quota came in, New Zealand and Ireland were like that with similar production. New Zealand went like that and we just stayed, obviously, with quotas. So we have, as I said, our supplier base, and we're the biggest processor in Ireland, we do 30% of the milk pool, have an ambition to grow by 60%. By 2020, and hence we're building the facility in Bellevue to support that. Now, we keep reminding them dairy volatility hasn't gone away, milk prices are coming off, having had a fantastic run in recent times. So the risks to that, I think, firstly, are that it's not done sensibly by processors and by farmers. So we would encourage our farmers to do it sensibly. We work with them on financial modelling so that they know their cost base, because it's not good for us if they don't go forward with a correct profile that can take the volatility of dairy. We work on risk minimisation. We're the first processor in Ireland to ever have three-year fixed milk price schemes. We're the first one in the world, actually, and people like Fonterra have spoken to us about that. So we connect our customers and our farmers with fixed milk price deals that helps them manage volatility. And ultimately, it is for the island of Ireland. about staying very true to that quality offering. I think there is actually a fantastic story to tell where we can point to a traceability, a sustainability and a quality that very few countries can point to. New Zealand have done that really well in terms of grass-fed production as a low-cost method of food production. I think Ireland can do it as very well. And in fairness, Minister Coveney is very supportive in that regard, and we work with Bord B and the various bodies, and obviously plough our own furrow in terms of telling that story as well. Because if you're a large food player at the moment and you're a large brand owner globally, you're thinking ultimately of sustainability, of where you're going to get the dairy from. And if you think of the areas of the globe that can produce dairy and the areas that wish to consume it, big growth in developing world from a consumption point of view, big growth in developed world from a production point of view. And the big areas of interest in terms of ability to grow and feed the world are areas like the US, where we're strong, and areas like Ireland in Europe, where we're strong. So while never being complacent that it's, again, not going to be linear, because dairy is a cycle, and the cure, we often say, for high prices in dairy is high prices, because supply responds and then it rebalances. But fundamentally, we do believe that there's a great opportunity, and it's about various parties. The government, we think, can do more to support the agri-sector. You'd probably say she would say that, wouldn't she? But I think they can. And there's various moves that have been made around, for example, encouraging partnership. Land is rarely traded in Ireland. You know, there's long heritage and history there, but we can encourage partnerships, encourage growth in a sensible way, encourage tax arrangements that would facilitate that, facilitate transfers to the younger folk, etc. But, you know, another interesting piece I would say about the opportunity that is in agriculture in Ireland. When we go to farmer meetings now, the demographic of the folk that we're engaging with is entirely different to what it would have been in the era of the Celtic Tiger, when the sons and daughters were off building roads in Gorey versus doing the farming piece at home. But that's completely changed. You know, the ag colleges are full. There's great ambition, and our role is to bring that to market, but equally encourage that it's done sensibly and not, for example, over leveraged and create another bubble of a different form. So fundamentally very positive, though, for the long-term position of dairy.
Hi, Stephen. Quick question. You mentioned you had been speaking with TPG recently, or originally. How easy or difficult is it to work with some of these funds? How demanding are they on a day-to-day basis? Generally, what's their investment horizon? Is it 3 to 5 years or longer term? How interested are they?
Mostly 3 to 5 year.
How interested are they?
Plans, and they are all IRR-driven. We had a very good relationship with TPG, which we set up in that intervening period when we were still sort of doing the workouts, but thinking, well, we may need capital, you know, when the markets open up again. But in a way, we were too early. I mean, the problem is that pre-September 2012, values were on the floor, but there was no liquidity. No one was buying, no one was selling. The problem for valuers, and there were valuations being done of everything, was that valuers were thinking, well, what would a client of mine pay if he was to buy this? But the point they were missing was that nobody would sell at those prices anyway, so actually nothing happened. There was no market at all. So we were in very early with TPG. But to your point, working with private equity is fine, except that you have to put up with getting to iteration number 45 of the model, you know, with conference calls in the middle of the night, and then some guy who's fresh out of Harvard, doesn't know where Cork is, gets involved in the decision, based in Cincinnati. And it just does your head in. And that was our problem. I suspect a few people probably that resonates with, because anyone, you know, I mean, they're great guys, and they're fun to work with, and they're very bright and all the rest of it. Now, I mean, some of them have been really good, and they've got stuck in, and people like Apollo and Lone Star, and now the new generation of Davidson Kempner and Varde and others, they're the ones that have brought liquidity to the market in Ireland. But people should be under no illusions. I mean, these are vulture funds. They're excited by distress. And they came to Ireland because of distress. Now what's happened is the distress is gone, but they really like it there. So they're finding all kinds of excuses to carry on, which is great.
Sorry, how do you find the impact of the supermarket wars in the UK and the growth of discounters? What's the impact of that, and how do you see that changing going forward in the future?
We don't have a consumer-facing business in the UK anymore. So our involvement in the supermarket shelves in the UK would be predominantly through our cheese products that we sell to the Irish Dairy Board, who have a relationship with Tesco. The reality is, but we have deep relationships with them in Ireland, as you can imagine, in our consumer products business. And it's that ebb and flow of a commercial relationship. It can be challenging. The reality is, I think different players look at it differently in different markets. If I compare the US, for example, to how it's conducted here in Europe, it is challenging. We try and work in a partnership model where best you can. That isn't always possible. But at the end of the day, our job ultimately is to deliver value for our shareholders. So to get the best we can with them as a partnership relationship, ultimately trying to play the long game. Not all parties will want to play that at all times. But that's the game that we have to try and play. I mean, ultimately, there is a lot of the key retailers in retail really do have that front of house market position. So you have to be with them. And so really, we need to keep bringing the agenda away from price, bringing it back to innovation, things that we can do to really help them in truth too, because obviously there's various challenges in how they're dealing with consumers. In Ireland, the discounters has been a big change, obviously, in terms of the overall market piece. And again, it's just another dynamic of working with them to ultimately try and have a value proposition for consumers, because ultimately it's the consumer who decides.
I mean, just to add to that, we run obviously a lot of shopping centres in Ireland, and these people are our tenants, so we deal with the supermarkets. And as you say, the whole thing has changed dramatically with the arrival of Aldi and Lidl, and then Musgraves, who've taken over Super Quinn, Dunnes is still there, and Tesco are really, really struggling and are pulling out of plans where they were planning new stores. That's really gone. So what you have an incredibly competitive and aggressive retail environment, with a sort of desperate battles going on between these retailers. It's a very interesting place to be right now, the supermarket scene in Ireland. And the rise of convenience stores, obviously.
Question down here at the end. Probably time for about two more questions, if that's okay. Siobhan, you're on a flight.
Just curious, as a property developer, do you see a lot more restrictions on raising funding now than you did previously that might prevent the bank issues in the future, or from a day-to-day perspective?
You mean in terms of equity raising?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's been a vintage period for REITs raising equity. It was a very good story because it gave access to play the recovery to funds that were listed only. So private equity had raised money from the same people but different hats within the big institutional investors. And so what we have in Ireland is now three new REITs. But they all have the same shareholders, and overwhelmingly they are American generalist investors who are playing Ireland, and they believe that Ireland is really well placed for growth. So it's not just the vulture thing I spoke about earlier. I mean, these funds are not—they're not just vultures now. They've actually come to the view that Ireland's going to be a real winner, and you know, I really hope they're right, and they may well be if the foreign direct investment continues. But I think the vintage era of the fundraising is probably over. I think any more new REITs in Ireland would certainly struggle to raise money. We don't want any more money. We don't know where our REIT business is heading in the future, because we're there to make money for the shareholders. So that means, see, in real estate, the really important thing is not to have a business plan. If you have a business plan in real estate, you're dead, because everyone else will just dream up the same business plan. We don't have all these mountains of cheese or thousands of people. It's really simple, very, very simple business. And the problem is, if it's appropriate to build offices, everyone's going to think the same thing. So if you just simply go along with the herd, it's great for a while, but it nearly always ends in tears. You've got to be flexible all the time and try and read what's happening and stay ahead of the pack. So I don't know the way it's going to play out, and we're telling our shareholders that we don't know how it's going to play out. All we're saying is we will make the money. They quite like that. That's grand.
From the other perspective, sorry, like from the other perspective,
leveraging
property?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, the debt markets are opening up. I mean, it was very, very difficult to get serious debt. Now what's happening is the banks are back in the game, but they don't want to do small loans, 15, 20 million, they're not really interested in. We've announced publicly that we're probably going to sign up a revolving credit facility shortly, and the other REITs, I think both of them have done that. And that would be like 150 million or something. And it's quite competitive. And it's not just the Irish banks. I could name four or five other international banks that are keen to build books in Ireland. And the margins have come in from, if you like, 450 bips to about 200 bips. So the potential for leverage is there. I personally think CMBS will come back, because I think CMBS, there was never anything wrong with it. It was a brilliant way of leveraging real estate. The problem is the people that were involved in it didn't do any proper due diligence. The bonds were sold to the wrong people. The whole thing was a shambles. And so it came to an end. But I think it will come back.
And in terms of growth, it seems to be the word of the evening. And I guess attracting investment and obviously tech companies coming to Ireland and et cetera, et cetera. Do you believe that Ireland has the infrastructure to support all this growth at the moment? Because ultimately population growth is what Ireland needs from a bigger picture perspective to drive all of these things. And I guess the question is just you, Stephen, is infrastructure investment from a private side of interest to you? Because obviously for Ireland to grow sustainably, there has to be an investment in infrastructure.
Yeah, we don't have any unique selling point in infrastructure. We've no particular expertise, and we are very, very focused on our own activities. So we only do mainstream commercial real estate in the UK and Ireland. We wouldn't get involved in a hotel or housing or leisure or France. We only do, you know, mainstream commercial real estate in the UK and Ireland. As far as infrastructure is concerned, I would make the observation that it was brilliant that it mostly got finished off just before everything went bang. So you can drive to Cork, you know, in less than 7 hours. It's brilliant. And then we also had a great overhang of apartments, which was exactly what Google and people wanted, mm-hmm. with people, kids coming in from, because they're all, you know, very young. Well, you lot are very young. They're very, very young, like 23 or something. So they all come in and they rent these apartments, and that's been great. The problem now is they've run out. And again, one thing I would say about NAMA, and this is not my field because I'm not a house builder, but I know an awful lot of people who are house builders, and several of them are very complimentary about the support that they've had from NAMA in helping them get going again and start building houses again. And we've some great house builders in Ireland, you know, everyone from Cosgrave to Mick Bailey. I mean, let them get out there and start building homes again. Gannon are building. So there's going to be a boom of house building, and that's really good.
Let it be an optimistic question.
It's sort of a follow-up question to the previous question about, do you have any ambition to diversify your portfolio, either in Ireland or outside of Ireland?
We've given commitments to the shareholders that going in the future, so long as we have the contract to manage the REIT, which you appreciate is externally managed. I mean, we don't work for the REIT. We conceived it, raised the money, built it, and we run it under a five-year contract. And while that contract runs, we won't do anything else in Ireland other than mind our own properties, which is what was left of the take private, which is still a big business. I mean, it has an income of about 50 million a year. It's a substantial business. But apart from that, we're not doing anything else in Ireland. Our UK business is in wind down because it's mostly about working for a group of banks, including GE Capital and some of the Irish banks and so on. That is kind of coming to an end. And I think our next big gig will be a completely new business, probably in the UK, but that's still some way down the line. We wouldn't want to raise capital to invest in the UK at the moment because we think it's a time to be a seller, not a buyer. What we're really interested in is trying to find an opportunity to do a management buy-in of an existing situation. But whether that happens or not is for the future. We're not even focused on it right now.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I think that we have exhausted the questions and hopefully we haven't exhausted our speakers. On behalf of Davy and Libs, can I thank you all very much for coming along this evening? Can I thank most sincerely Siobhan and Stephen for being so generous with their time and with their stories? And if we could show your appreciation, please, for their contribution.
You have been listening to a podcast by the London Irish Business Society. We would especially like to thank Davy for helping to produce this event, and thank our sponsors P-Cubed and Michael Page Banking and Financial Services for their ongoing support. You can read more about the Society, its events, and join for free membership at www.li-bs.co.uk.